In the continued detention of oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition and demanded their release.
We hope that the new U.S. administration would lift the blockade on Yemen, but unfortunately it seems it is following the same policy. Not a single liter of oil derivatives has been released over the past weeks. The suffocating siege has deprived millions of Yemenis of fuel and deteriorated their life conditions.
The fuel crisis has deeply impacted the health sector of Yemen, as major hospitals like Al-Thawra and Sana'a are on the verge of closure due to lack of fuel to provide health services.
Our health sector is negatively impacted by the siege. Some hospitals have stopped offering services due to lack of fuel. Intensive care rooms do not work any longer. The siege is targeting the lives of our nation. We call on the world to step in and put an end to this crisis.
12 Yemeni oil vessels are still detained by the Saudi-led coalition, contributing to the humanitarian crisis in Yemen that is on the brink of famine due to the Saudi-led war underway since 2015. Yemenis blame the United Nations for its inaction against the Saudi Arabia's illegal detention of oil ships. They say the UN inaction contributes to Yemen's deprivation of oil derivatives stored on the ships. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Studies now reveal that child poverty jumped nearly 10% in 2020, meaning one in six children lives in poverty in the richest country in the world. The same study found that if Washington gave direct payments to parents totaling $85 billion, or just 0.4% of its GDP, the child poverty rate would plummet 75% and affect only one in 20 children.
The American capitalist ideology has a strong hold on everybody in every class. There is only a set of notions that, you know, kids are poor because their parents are stupid or their parents are lazy and therefore they don't deserve it. Or if we spend the money to do something for kids, we're all going to go bankrupt. The whole country's going to go bankrupt. This is all this nonsense is out there.
Congress is touting a plan to increase the child tax credit from $2,000 to $3,000 annually. Many note that's a refund for those with jobs and not an immediate direct payment to buy children diapers, food, school supplies, and other necessities. The extra $1,000 tax refund would cover only about 6 weeks of child care, as their costs have risen 60% since the start of the pandemic.
All of these things are happening to big swaths of the American people that are never represented on, you know, mainstream media to the world, never projected out to the world. And we can solve them. There's nothing that prevents us from solving them besides political will.
The discussions on child poverty come as Congress has postponed yet again a long-awaited round of major household stimulus, this time in order to focus on the second impeachment trial of ex-President Donald Trump. Last year, American-style lockdowns led to the largest annual increase in the overall poverty rate in more than 50 years. Many say the problem is not poor children or even poor parents, but the long-standing political indifference towards both groups. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The clashes between the police and the government employees in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. The security forces use excessive tear gas to prevent opposition-backed protesters who government fears could have besieged country's parliament. They demanded the government to raise their salaries by 40% to compensate them over massive price hike and inflation after Pakistan devalued its currency under an intense IMF pressure.
Tear gas and the lathi charge, that is really shameful because we are not terrorists. Our salaries should be increased, should be competitive, because when Imran Khan government took charge, inflation rate, you can see 300% inflation rate has been high and increased during the the previous 2.5 years, and we are still the PTI government has not increased even 1% our salaries in the last budget.
The protests by the government employees disrupted the usual official business across the country at a time when the mainstream opposition parties joined hands against Prime Minister Imran Khan's government to oust him from power over alleged rigging in 2018's general elections.
We condemn the brutal violence on government employees. It is incredible to see such excessive use of force against the government employees. If they do not work in their offices, the government business would come to a grinding half. Will Imran Khan alone run the government?
Fearing the politicization of the protest, a better sense prevailed and Prime Minister Imran Khan's government apologized with the protesting employees of the government and finally successfully negotiated with the leaders of the employees' union to end their protest. The government has announced to increase a 25% raise in their salaries. The troubles for the government are far from over. The mainstream opposition parties are all set to start a long march from all over Pakistan to capital Islamabad next month. However, with the end of the protest of employees, the government has managed to contain the crisis from being aggravated ahead of a long march. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
These kind of actions calling for the boycott of Israeli products will not be possible anymore if the French Minister of Justice, Dupont-Moretti, succeeds in his intentions. In a letter, he instructed all prosecutors, magistrates and judges in France to condemn appeals to boycott Israeli products because it is a discrimination against the nation, he says. But an important group of French people reacted publicly, stating that BDS is legitimate and legal. In June last year, the European Court for Human Rights said that boycott is a legal political weapon. Pierre Stamboul is member of the board of the French Jewish Union for Peace and a BDS activist. His father was deported by the Nazis.
In France and in the USA, many Jews are involved in the BDS movement because Israel and the Zionist movement commit crimes against the Palestinians. The Israeli policy is an insult to our memory, our history and our identity. Today we see that France is again complicit with Israel, but nevertheless, France has been condemned by the European Court of Human Rights to pay 100,000 euros to BDS activists who organized the boycott action.
For lawyer Dominique Cochin, the judgment of the European Court prevails over the French directives.
That means that France is committed to respect the judgments of the European Court of Human Rights. Minister Moretti pretends to obey this judgment. It says in Article 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights that the boycott is a totally legitimate political way of expression. But the French Minister of Justice, with this letter, tries again to criminalize the appeal to boycott.
The appeal to BDS has been launched by the Palestinians in 2005 and had a support all over the world, with remarkable events also in France, with actions in supermarkets or boat protests against the inauguration of a Ben-Gurion square. They ask the end of the colonization and occupation of Palestine. The French Minister of Justice would like BDS activists to appear in courthouses to be condemned for criticizing Israel. That will not be easy because most lawsuits against BDS are won by the activists till now. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
The clashes between the police and the government employees in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. The security forces use excessive tear gas to prevent opposition-backed protesters who government fears could have besieged country's parliament. They demanded the government to raise their salaries by 40% to compensate them over massive price hike and inflation after Pakistan devalued its currency under an intense IMF pressure.
Tear gas and the lathi charge, that is really shameful because we are not terrorists. Our salaries should be increased, should be competitive because when Imran Khan government took charge, inflation rate, you can see 300%. Inflation rate has been high and increased during the previous 2.5 years. And we are still, the PTI government has not increased even 1% or salaries in the last budget.
The protests by the government employees disrupted the usual official business across the country at a time when the mainstream opposition parties joined hands against Prime Minister Imran Khan's government to oust him from power over alleged rigging in 2018's general elections.
We condemn the brutal violence in government employees. It is incredible to see such excessive use of force against the government employees. If they do not work in their offices, the government business would come to a grinding half. Will Imran Khan alone run the government?
Fearing the politicization of the protest, a better sense prevailed and Prime Minister Imran Khan's government apologized with the protesting employees of the government and finally successfully negotiated with the leaders of the employees' union to end their protest. The government has announced to increase a 25% raise in their salaries. The troubles for the government are far from over. The mainstream opposition parties are all set to start a long march from all over Pakistan to capital Islamabad next month. However, with the end of the protest of employees, the government has managed to contain the crisis from being aggravated ahead of a long march. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The seventh so-called Ukraine Association Council meeting has just taken place in Brussels. The delegation that travelled from Kiev used the opportunity to encourage the EU to ramp up its sanctions against Moscow.
We hope that the deep sanctions regime for violations of human rights would allow for the enhancement of the sanctions list and the expansion of the sanctions list of the European Union.
Russia denies claims it is trying to destabilize Ukraine and asserts its right to protect what it sees as legitimate regional interests. Just like several other nations surrounding Russia, the EU would like Ukraine to join its 27-nation bloc.
The European Union has already provided significant overall financial assistance to Ukraine. We are talking about 16 billion euros since 2014.
The EU regularly reminds us of its values, but critics say the bloc is often willing to look the other way in pursuit of its ambitions to further expand and to isolate Russia. After all, Ukraine is consistently ranked one of the most corrupt countries in the world. The EU needs Russia. The European Commission's own website says two-thirds of the EU's oil imports come from Russia, as do three-quarters of its gas imports. A new pipeline from Russia to Germany, which is 90% complete, is set to double the EU's gas imports. We don't need a new Cold War, many argue.
As a Russian speaker living in the European Union, not me only, but 6 million we are all over, we want good relations, we don't want war.
Earlier this week, EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell attracted scathing criticism in the European Parliament.
High Representative Borrell, you should resign.
This was for going ahead with an official visit to Moscow last week. However, some legislators expressed an alternative view.
This isn't about human rights. This is a geopolitical agenda against Russia, fueled by a military-industrial complex who need an enemy to justify their millions.
If that is true, as citizens, most of us clearly underestimate the power of the arms industry. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
As the nation's media and political elite are consumed by the impeachment trial of ex-President Donald Trump, talks on a desperately needed and long-delayed major economic stimulus package have been forced on hold. After an economically devastating pandemic year, Main Street has been clamoring for economic aid. President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion relief bill has a huge 75% public approval rating. But as Democrats issue more of the exact details, fissures are mounting between their left and right factions. Republicans who want to reduce the stimulus package are being accused of defying public opinion. Discontent is also rising as Biden's proposal backtracks, pulls his support, or reduces a host of economic promises, ending Trump's signature tax cuts for the rich, student debt relief, the amount of and length of unemployment payments, the total amount of household stimulus checks, and all while many say Main Street needed all of that and more in the world's richest country.
If we're not talking about $2,000 per month with retro pay and also a forgiveness of all mortgages as well as rent, and I don't mean like moratorium where they have to pay it down the line. If you couldn't pay $1,000 a month, then you're not going to be able to pay $5,000 over the course of 5 months to do it. That's just asinine.
There is mounting backlash over Biden's plan to abandon the proposed raising of the minimum wage from $7 to $15 an hour. Such an increase wouldn't just reverse decades of soaring wage inequality, it would spur much-needed economic growth amid the pandemic recession. The federal minimum wage has not been lifted in over a decade, further impoverishing the nation's working poor and lower classes. The gap between campaign promises and what looks like will actually be delivered may explain why a top poll recently showed that 70% of the nation is dissatisfied with, quote, the way things are going in the nation today.
Capitalism needs this to be put on pause. Actually, I mean, you know, my opinion, capitalism needs to be replaced, but capitalism needs to be on pause from the banks on down. And the reality is, if these measures are not done, these drastic measures are not done, then no, America won't heal.
Mid-March is the earliest date the third stimulus is likely to be passed. Reduced unemployment benefits from the modest and also last-minute second stimulus package will expire by April. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
What was called a forgotten crisis has once again become front-page news. The brutal war on Yemen, waged by a Saudi-led coalition, aided and abetted by Western powers, in particular the U.S. and the U.K. It's a war that's killed more than 100,000 people, destroyed much of Yemen's infrastructure, and subjected more than 20 million of its population to famine. But last week, an apparent change in policy, an end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen, announced by U.S. President Joe Biden, received with cautious optimism for its ambiguous wording. Across the Atlantic, a different reaction from the second leading arms supplier to Saudi Arabia. The decision the U.S. takes on matters of arms sales are decisions for the U.S. The U.K. takes its own arms export responsibilities very seriously, and we continue to assess all arms export licenses in accordance with strict licensing criteria. Those campaigning to end the UK weapons exports to Riyadh beg to differ. In 2019, following a case brought by the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, led to a UK court decision banning the sale of UK-made arms to Saudi-led forces over breaches of international humanitarian law. A year later, that ruling was overturned.
Well, they say that all the licenses are double-checked and that actually the weapons that they're selling to Saudi Arabia are not being used in the war on Yemen. This is palpably not the case.
Since the bombing of Yemen began in March 2015, the UK has licensed £6.8 billion worth of arms to the Saudi regime, including more than £2.5 billion in the form of aircraft, helicopters, and drones, and nearly £4 billion in grenades, bombs, missiles, and countermeasures.
I think the figures show just how central Britain is to the ongoing war effort in the Saudi-led coalition. You know, these are huge amounts of offensive weapons that are being sold. And we've even had spokespeople from BAE Systems saying that their involvement, the involvement of this key British company in the war effort, is basically essential to the maintenance of the bombing campaign the Saudis are involved in.
The UK's biggest arms company, BAE Systems, has pocketed £15 billion from services and sales to Saudi Arabia since the Yemen war began.
An end to arms sales alone may not terminate the war in Yemen, but it could be the beginning of the end. Perhaps it's time for the UK government to put its conscience before its arms industry and prevent the humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen from escalating any further. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagheer Ghalibaf visited Moscow for talks with a number of Russian officials on regional and international issues aimed at further cementing the two sides' strategic relations. In a meeting with the chairwoman of Federation Council of Russia, Valentina Matviyenko, Ghalibaf said his visit to Russia has become special since he carries a message from Iran's Islamic Revolution leader Ayatollah Sayed Ali Khamenei to Russian President Vladimir Putin.
This important message is about the region and the world powers and has the meaning that the bilateral relation between Iran and Russia will be strategic and deep for several decades. Iran's leader has also thanked the Russian Federation and China for the fair position on the Iran nuclear deal. Europe and the US did not fulfill their obligations under the JCPOA.
The Iranian official also made it clear that Iran has received nothing from the JCPOA other than sanctions and underlined that Iran will do its best to neutralize unilateral sanctions imposed on the country.
Our goal is to neutralize sanctions, that is, to strengthen our economy through expanding ties with friendly countries that have independence in decision-making.
For her part, chairwoman of the Federation Council of Russia said the visit of Ghalibaf would give fresh impetus to the relations between the two states. She also said that Moscow is eager to expand ties with Iran despite obstacles on this way.
Industry, clean energy, counterterrorism, defense, technology, culture are areas of strategy, and this is where Russia and Iran say they can establish cooperation to counter the U.S. unilateralism as well as their culture of dominance.
This visit is intended to help Russia and Iran find a ground for further cooperation. This will help us to stop the global wave of chaos and lawlessness. This will also pave the way for putting an end to the immoral sanctions on Iran and the Russian Federation.
Iranian Parliament Speaker arrived in Moscow on Sunday at the official invitation of Russia's State Duma at the head of a high-ranking parliamentary delegation. During his visit, he held talks with some senior Russian officials, including Secretary of Security Council of Russia Nikolai Patrushev, on a number of regional and international issues, from terrorism to upcoming international meeting on Syria in the Astana format in Sochi. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Donald Trump has been acquitted by the U.S. Senate in his second impeachment trial for his role in the 6th of January attack on the U.S. Capitol, a verdict that underscores the sway America's 45th president still holds over the Republican Party, even after leaving office. It was always unlikely that 17 Republican senators would jump ship and join Democrats to impeach former President Trump. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Observer columnists Sam Levine and Lauren Gambino. The piece is titled, Donald Trump Acquitted in Second Impeachment Trial. Stay with us for more of Sam Levine and Lauren Gambino's article. Donald Trump has been acquitted by the U.S. Senate in his second impeachment trial for his role in the 6th of January attack on the U.S. Capitol, a verdict that underscores the sway America's 45th president still holds over the Republican Party even after leaving office. It was always unlikely that 17 Republican senators would jump ship and join Democrats to impeach former President Donald Trump. After just 5 days of debate in the chamber that was the scene of last month's invasion, a divided Senate fell 10 votes short of the two-thirds majority required to convict high crimes and misdemeanors. A conviction would have allowed the Senate to vote to disqualify Donald J. Trump from holding future office. 7 Republicans joined every Democrat to declare Trump guilty on the charge of incitement of insurrection after his months-long quest to overturn his defeat by Joe Biden and its deadly conclusion on 6th of January when Congress met to formalize the election results. The 57-43 vote was most partisan support for conviction ever in a presidential impeachment trial. The outcome, which was never in doubt, reflected both the still raw anger of senators over Donald Trump's conduct and his supporters as his supporters stormed the Capitol last month, and the vice-like grip the defeated president still holds over the Republican Party. Among the Republicans willing to defy Trump were Richard Burr of North Carolina, Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Mitt Romney of Utah, Ben Sasse of Nebraska, and Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania. The swift conclusion of the Senate trial, only the 4th presidential impeachment in American history, and Donald Trump's 2nd in just over a year, capped one of the most tumultuous chapters in the nation's political history. Still shaken by the deadly riot that threatened America's commitment to a peaceful transfer of power, senators of both parties were eager to turn the page. Trump's acquittal came after grave warnings from the 9 Democratic House managers serving as prosecutors that Donald Trump continued to pose a threat to the nation and to democracy itself. If this is not a high crime and misdemeanor against the United States of America, then nothing is, Congressman Jamie Raskin, the lead manager, pleaded with senators in the final moments before they rendered their judgments as jurors and witnesses. President Trump must be convicted for the safety and democracy of our people. From the outset, Donald Trump's allies in the Senate made clear they had no intention of convicting him. Though many Republicans explicitly supported or implicitly indulged Trump's baseless claim of a stolen election, few defended his actions during the trial itself. Instead, they relied on a technical argument advanced by his attorneys and rejected by a majority of the Senate, as well as leading constitutional scholars, that the proceedings were unconstitutional because Donald Trump was no longer in office. In a floor speech after the vote, Senator Mitch McConnell, the minority leader in the Senate, said Donald Trump's conduct preceding the assault on the Capitol amounted to a disgraceful dereliction of duty by the former president, who he held practically and morally responsible for promoting the events of Wednesday, 6th of January. But Mitch McConnell concluded that the Senate was never meant to serve as a moral tribunal and suggested instead that Donald Trump could still face criminal prosecution. President Trump is still liable for everything he did whilst he was in office, Mitch McConnell said. He didn't get away with anything yet. At a news conference after the vote, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi denounced as cowardly the Republicans who voted to spare Trump on procedural grounds and said she would refuse to entertain their calls for a censure. "We censure people for using stationery for the wrong purpose," she said, her voice rising in indignation. "We don't censure people for inciting insurrection." Just moments after the not guilty verdict was announced, a defiant Donald Trump thanked Republicans who stood by him and decried what he called yet another phase of the greatest witch hunt in the history of our country. In his statement, Donald Trump expressed no remorse and made no mention of the violence that unfolded in his name on Wednesday, 6th of January, but signaled his desire to remain a political force within the Republican Party. "Our historic, patriotic, and beautiful movement to make America great again has only just begun," he declared triumphantly. Donald Trump is the first U.S. president to be impeached twice and is now the first president to be twice acquitted. The decision leaves him free to pursue another tilt at the White House in 2024, though opinion polls suggest the violent end of his presidency left his reputation badly damaged. The House of Representatives impeached Trump in his final days in office on one charge of incitement of insurrection of the siege on the U.S. Capitol. He invited supporters to Washington on the day Electoral College votes were being counted, told them to fight like hell, and encouraged them to go to the U.S. Capitol, Democrats charged. Once the attack on the Capitol turned deadly, placing Vice President Mike Pence, members of Congress, and Capitol Hill employees in danger, Donald Trump violated his oath of office by failing to defend the U.S. government against the attack, the impeachment article alleged. The attack came after Donald Trump spent weeks trying to overturn the results of the November 2020 election. Five people died as a direct result of the assault, including a police officer, and scores of others were seriously injured. During the two-day presentation, prosecutors played harrowing and never-before-seen security footage of the attack to bolster their case that Donald Trump had deliberately fomented insurrection by whipping up his followers who believed they were acting on his instructions. Crucially, they argued, the Capitol siege was not just a result of the speech Donald Trump gave on Wednesday, 6th of January, but a foreseeable result after he spent years sanctioning violence among his supporters. In a chamber protesters breached, the Democrats' case was by turns emotional and visceral. It offered new insight into the scope of the violence that transpired, and senators learned for the first time how close the nation's political leaders came to the mob that haunted them. The striking evidence presented was a notable contrast to Trump's first impeachment trial, which was built around documents and testimony regarding his effort to pressure Ukrainian officials to help him politically. After Democrats concluded their arguments, Trump's lawyers used just a fraction of the 16 hours allocated for their case. They used a smattering of approaches, arguing Trump could not be tried because he had already left office and that his speech did not amount to an incitement of violence, and was protected by the First Amendment. During their brief presentation on Friday, 12th of February, Trump's lawyers argued that he was using the same kind of rhetoric politicians frequently use, and said the trial was a political witch hunt and that Trump was a victim of constitutional cancel culture. Those arguments largely seemed to be an effort to distort the case against Trump and obscure the unique context under which he encouraged his supporters to disrupt the activities of the US government as it facilitated the peaceful transfer of power. The vote, on Saturday, 13th of February, came after the proceedings were briefly thrown into chaos when the House managers unexpectedly moved to call witnesses in an effort to shed light on Trump's state of mind as the assault unfolded on the Capitol building. Caught off guard, Trump's legal team threatened to depose at least over 100 witnesses and said Nancy Pelosi was at the top of their list. After a frantic bout of uncertainty in which it appeared the manager's request could prolong the trial for several more weeks, senators struck a deal with the prosecution and Trump's lawyers to avert calling witnesses. Instead, they agreed to enter as evidence the written statement of a Republican congresswoman who had been told that Donald Trump sided with the rioters after the House Minority Leader pleaded with him to stop the attack on Wednesday, 6th of January. Embracing Trump's combative and fact-bending approach, his lawyers declared him innocent of the charges against him and denounced the trial as a final desperate attempt by Democrats to disqualify their most despised opponent from public office. "You do not have to indulge the impeachment lust, the dishonesty and the hypocrisy," Michael Van der Veen, one of Donald Trump's lawyers, told senators. With the result a foregone conclusion, the Democratic managers summoned the weight of history, reminding senators of the consequential votes taken by their forebearers in the same chamber, from abolishing slavery to passing the Civil Rights Act and imposing sanctions on apartheid South Africa. Difficult in the moment, the managers said, these votes defined their legacies and changed the course of American history. "There are moments that transcend party politics and that require us to put country above our political party, because the consequences of not doing so are just too great," said one of the House managers, Joe Neguse. Neguse added, "Senators, this is one such moment."
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we're going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise the children Islamically. We have in our studio guest speaker, Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, dear Sister Salma Khalfan.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for inviting me over.
You're welcome. So we'll start off with our first question. There's a question saying that how do we abstain from domestic quarrels at home, and what effect does it have on children, on their upbringing? And later on, it even asked, how do we even avoid these conflicts?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Domestic quarrels are something that is very common in every home. But of course, it depends on how much it is, like how far it has been taken to. Mm-hmm. If it's just a normal quarrel that can be reformed easily, and it wouldn't lay a very bad impact on the child. Mm-hmm. But of course, it doesn't mean that it should not be avoided. All but right. Yes, abstaining from these domestic differences is of paramount importance for the upbringing of the child, especially the Islamic upbringing of the child.
Okay.
So that the psyche is pure and untainted and the potentials are exposed the way Allah has given us this amanat, right? Mm. A child, our children. So if we taint them, one of the ways of tainting them is through these quarrels, domestic quarrels, because it can really affect them badly in the long run.
Okay.
Even when they're adults, they won't forget such scenes. It won't be erased in their minds.
Mm. But then, as you say, the quarrels are always there in life, like ups and downs and stuff. So can you elaborate a bit more on exactly how the thing is, till where can you say, okay, they're just normal quarrels and not like...
Yeah, we'll come to that later.
Okay.
But for now, I want to explain about why is it so significant for a child to be, in an atmosphere that is very peaceful with no quarrels, no loud noises, Even Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us in the Holy Quran, "Inna ankara al-aswat la sawt al-hamir," the worst of the sounds is the sound of a donkey. Mm-hmm. So like loud voices and, quarreling and everything really affects the child, especially if the child is like just born and he will be adapted to that kind of lifestyle, which has a very detrimental effect on his psyche, his emotions, his even physical well-being.
I guess if you go and see, it even has an effect on the older people, let alone the kids.
That's right, absolutely. So what about the kids, right? They're so fragile and delicate. So of course, first come the kids, and here we're talking about Islamic upbringing, so we need to lay emphasis on the kids. So for a child, the home is like a nest, He feels very much attached to it. His heart is always tied to this nest. And if the parents themselves are on friendly terms with each other, and of course with the children around them, then this nest remains durable, like a warm lap. It becomes stronger and stronger as days go by.
Mm-hmm.
But the child feels... in such a home, the child feels contented and secure.
Okay.
These are the effects of the nest, the warm lap.
Mm.
He gets an upbringing in such an atmosphere that his capabilities are, truly expressed.
Yes.
The way he's born with these capabilities that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has granted and bestowed upon him. And it'll have a very great results. His potential will be really actualized in a very beautiful manner.
Okay, dear listeners, let's take a break. Stay tuned and don't go away. We'll be back soon.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir. Welcome back. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Yes, Sister Salma Khafan, we're talking on the effects that that the domestic quarrels have on the children, and that it's very significant to have like a very peaceful atmosphere for the kids, because it can have really detrimental effects. Yes,
that's right. So if the parents are always fighting and they're excitable, then the children will lose his calm and contentment, and they will always be uneasy and restless.
Okay.
Now, I recall in my extended family, very far off, I saw a child in her childhood,
okay.
And she was a very cute and pretty child, you know. And, but when I saw her after a few years, I saw a bad sulk on her face, a pretty face. And I was surprised. Why is this sulk always there when you even try to, you know, laugh with the child? The sulk is always there. And then I came to know that there were domestic quarrels, a lot of domestic quarrels in the house. And that brought that sulk in her face. And now this child is also married. But you see that however she tries to portray herself, but the sulk is there.
It just breaks the child down.
It just breaks the child down. And there's so many detrimental effects that we, inshallah, are going to talk about. So these are the effects physically even seen, you know. We are surprised that
So that's just physical, but then what they have inside.
So what about the emotional? It must be like a completely, you know, she must be a very bothered child, So the parents who argue and fight do not realize that the feelings of the poor child in such a situation gets frightened. She gets frightened and hurt. In fact, the child begins to feel actually that it's probably her fault. Or even she feels that just now the bang will go on her, you know.
And somehow I guess they're pushed away when, you know, the parents are always fighting and quarreling with each other. So they're not given that attention as well.
Of course, of
course. So I guess that would be the reason.
They're pushed away as well, and they're not paid attention to the way they're supposed to. And in fact, you know, this shows that how selfish the parents are, right? How selfish nature they are, that they don't think about their child. And you see other parents on the other side, they're so smart that they go in their rooms and they talk about the matter. So they are both sides.
Yeah, because quarrels are always there. So in order to sort them out, there should be some different ways.
Of course, there should be a privacy. There should be an area where you can't talk openly to the child. Even if he's a big child. You know, of about matured level child, like for example 12, 13 year old, it's very much more advisable not to talk it out. You know, I remember there was a family whose parents, whose mother was sick and tired of the spouse, and she said that she told the son that I'm going to divorce your father. She thought that she's so smart because the son is like maybe 15 year old, he would understand. But he started crying and saying that please don't take a divorce, where will I be at this point in time. So there are many detrimental effects.
When mother and the father are together, they feel that warmth.
That nest, nest of security, and they feel protected. So there are many experiences I would like to state so that we can have a clearer picture of when parents do like this, what happens to the children as they grow up. And that's how we'll outline what happens, you know, like in the long run, how the effects come about in a child in the long run. So they also, you know, try to hide themselves in a corner. And, you know, they wonder also why the parents are behaving in such a manner. While the adults, while the mother is having a role of taking care of the child, nursing the child. So the child feels, my mother is everything to me. And then suddenly he sees this, you know, like a quarrel, a quarrelsome manner. And he gets very frightened and he becomes, you know, like his... His mind goes wayward that what is this? The good and bad mixed together.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay, we'll continue after the break. Stay tuned, dear listeners. We'll be back soon.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Yes, Sister Khalfan. We were talking about the contentment that a child has when the parents don't fight in the house, and that they get agitated and they, you know, lose that peace and calm in their hearts and they feel and disturbed.
That's right. These are the consequences of what happens to a child. They seek avenues of fleeing from this nest, this warm lap, and which has been so dear for them, like a mother. I told you, he thinks now there are two sides of a mother, the good and the bad. You know?
So it breaks that picture, the good picture that they had of the mother or the father. Then it kind of changes somebody whom they looked up to, and now it's not the same person. So it kind of... it's very difficult, I think,
for
the
difficult
child.
And then, you know what, he seeks solace in the bazaar, the people outside, his friends, who would show their best. You know, not the real picture, not the reality. I mean, friends are friends in the long run, but who will be of, you know, like, use in for you? in the long run.
Because friends
it'll be just
and
parents
everybody,
and
yeah,
family, right?
True, yes.
And however much a mother and father do like such behavior, they have fights and everything, you'll see still their heart loving and longing for the child.
True.
But
yes.
The child will have separated from their heart, from his heart towards his parents. He will feel that insecurity, this frightful nature in him that'll take him even towards adulthood, because such memories never erase. It is said that a child, you know, always remembers memories that are like not at a personal level but at a family and social level. Like if you give him a toy or a lollipop or a chocolate, this will probably erase from his mind. But that social get together, that when one praises the child in a social gathering, one, you know, like plays together, has fun together, excitable, you know, scenes and everything, this kind of memories never erase from a child. But and likewise, when memories like these come up, for example, when parents are fighting and the whole house is, you know, like blasting with loud noises.
True,
so this really makes the child ache inside, and he will never forget that. You know, in the long run.
Exactly.
So the child is unable to forget such scenes the whole of his life, and the events remain etched on his psyche, and they have such detrimental effects on his nature also. And you know, sadly, it'll affect his future relationships sometimes. And we will see such examples sometimes. I'm not saying all the time, because sometimes, you know, he feels that no family can be so perfect. And there doesn't exist a family like that. You know, it's like however we were brought up with, whatever kind of culture or habits we were brought up with, and suddenly we see something performed in a different way, we feel, does it really exist? You know, let's ask ourselves about it, does it really exist? It probably doesn't. It's just a myth or something. But this is how it happens to them, the children. Yeah, they feel that such loud noises and fighting and quarreling nature is normal. So there doesn't exist a peaceful life, a peaceful father.
So they end up having the same
life. A peaceful wife. Exactly. Yeah. So they end up having the same they follow the same pattern.
Yeah.
In fact, they follow the same pattern, which is more dangerous, right?
Or maybe even like, sometimes even the parents, most of the times you can say the parents do it unintentionally, not knowing the effects that it has on the children, and then it just goes on in generations over generations.
Yes, generations, you see. It becomes the genetic makeup.
So it's just spoiling the whole generations.
Exactly. Like. So such akhlaq is very important in the parents, and it starts with the akhlaq.
Okay. Sister Khalfan, do you have more points to add up to this question?
Yes, lots of more points,
So inshallah, we'll continue on in the next session, inshallah. So before we end up, I would just like to summarize. Sister Salma Khalfan, you talked about the detrimental effect the domestic quarrels have on the children, and that if they don't get their love and warmth and care and the peace at home, then they go outside looking for it. Inshallah, we'll continue in the next session. Thank you very much for joining us on this program. And dear audience, if you have any questions, any comments, any suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. And subscribe to our YouTube channel and Facebook page, Call of Islam Radio. Inshallah, till the next program, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned, perfect with no flaws at all, are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet
Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.